These words from Václav Havel, Czech playwright, poet, and political dissident, who after the fall of communism was president of Czechoslovakia and of the Czech Republic. Hope is a state of mind, not of the world. Either we have hope or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul. And it's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not procrastination. No, sorry. Prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizon. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously heading for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. The more worthy the situation in which we demonstrate hope, the deeper the hope is. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the faith that something makes sense regardless of how it turns out.
In the last installment of the science fiction trilogy, The Matrix Revolutions, there's an epic battle between the evil Agent Smith and the hero Neo, born Thomas Anderson. It's an understatement to call it overly dramatic, but it's also a compelling look at the topic of hope and, I think, an insight into Unitarian Universalist theology. Why do we hope? Not because we have found the truth, but because we choose to give meaning to our lives. I'm going to read the dialogue here, and then I have the clip. I don't want to read the dialogue in case the clip doesn't come through as clearly. They're having this epic battle, and Neo appears to be beaten. Of course, we know he's not beaten, but he appears to be out of it. And Agent Smith says, "Why, Mr. Anderson, why do you do it? Why get up? Why keep fighting? Do you believe you're fighting for something? For more than your survival? Can you tell me what it is? You don't even know. Is it freedom or truth? Perhaps peace? Could it be love? Illusions, Mr. Anderson. Vagaries of perception. The temporary constructs of a feeble human intellect trying desperately to justify an existence that is without meaning or purpose. And all of them as artificial as the matrix itself. Although only a human mind could invent something as insipid as love. You must be able to see it, Mr. Anderson. You must know it by now. You can't win. It's pointless to keep fighting. Why, Mr. Anderson? Why do you persist?" The response from Neo is, "Because I choose to."
Without meaning or purpose, but all of them as artificial as the matrix
Because I choose to. He answered, because I choose to. So how do we give meaning to our lives? How do we carry on when all things seem lost? How do we transmit our values, our culture, our traditions across generations, across time? This morning, I wanted to take a look at the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah for some insight into those questions. The story of Hanukkah, like all good stories, is really quite simple. The Jewish people of Jerusalem were being forced to adopt the gods of the conquering Greeks. Their sacred temple was defiled. Their valuable artifacts were stolen. Foreign idols were placed in their temples, and they were compelled to worship the gods of the Greeks and forsake their own traditions. At this disastrous time, there arose a hero, Judah Maccabee, who led a successful revolt against impossible odds and drove the Greeks back and rededicated the sacred temple. Miraculously, the oil lamp, when lit on the rededication, burned for 8 days when there was only enough oil for one day. That's the story. Story of hope in the face of overwhelming odds. A story of the miracle of the continuation of the Jewish faith in the face of certain assimilation. And today that story is told by religious and secular Jews around the world at this time of year. It's a beautiful and compelling story, and that's the first step in conveying values and traditions across centuries. Tell a beautiful and compelling story. So when I was thinking about speaking about Hanukkah and then looked a little bit of information up, I was struck almost immediately by the parallels with what's happened to our indigenous people in North America. Overwhelmed by another culture. Forbidden to practice their religion. Their sacred artifacts taken away from them. I reached out to friends, Rabbi David Ellis and Rabbi Reish Weiss. And they gave me food for thought. Rabbi Weiss thought it was an interesting parallel. But in her words, my biggest concern would be unintentionally minimizing the plight of the First Nations in Canada. In other words, the injustice done to the Indigenous people of this land is greater than the injustice inflicted on the Jewish people 2,200 years ago. And both rabbis set me straight on the difference between the story of Hanukkah, that beautiful brief story I just told you, and the facts of what happened historically as we know them today. It's generally now believed that the revolt led by Judah Maccabee was as much a revolt against other Jews as it was against the Greek occupiers. Many Jews were happy with the prosperity that Greek culture and technology had brought with it, and they were more than willing to be assimilated into the new reality of a Hellenized Jerusalem. And also, the miraculous event of the oil lasting 8 days is a late addition to the story. No basis in historic fact. It's first found in Talmudic writings some 600 years after the event. The revolt is a tragedy. 4 years later, the Jews were confronted by a 20,000-strong army. And in a battle in 160 BC, they were crushed and Judah Maccabee was killed. But some years later, in the seesaw of Jewish fortune, changes in the geopolitical landscape would lead Judah's youngest brother to ascend as the high priesthood, and the establishment of the Hasmonean dynasty that would rule in independent Judea from 140 to 37 BCE, when again, in this case, the Romans would crush the Jews. Rabbi Michael Schlesbach has written about the manner in which the Maccabees preserved their Jewish identity in the face of a culture that threatened to overwhelm them. And I quote here. In the revolt's aftermath, the Maccabees established a dynasty that would last more than 100 years. Secure in their independence, these Hasmonean kings adopted Greek-style names, and their Jewish subjects followed suit, and once again imitating the Greeks. This time, however, imitation didn't threaten, but rather ensured Jewish survival. To celebrate their mighty triumph, the Jews added a new 8-day festival. And this was something that the Jews would never do. All of the festivals were prescribed in Torah. And now they're adding a new festival. The very notion of creating a religious holiday to commemorate a military victory was a Greek idea, as heretofore all Jewish festivals were commanded from the Torah. Other Greek ideas that crept into Jewish thought included notions of an afterlife and a soul. So you might ask if the Maccabees, those bulwarks against assimilation, succumbed to Greek styles of and influence, how are they different from the pro-Greek Jews that they had once so violently opposed? I'm continuing with the quote here. See, the Maccabees were Jews first, and thus they were highly selective in determining which traditions were essential. In contrast, the assimilationists knew no boundaries. They would have traded Zeus for God and trophies for circumcision, discarding the ancient mark of the covenant of the people. The genius of the Maccabees in their response to Hellenism was in hewing to a narrow path between twin perils of assimilation on one hand and isolation on the other. This approach of preserving what makes Jewish is what makes Jewish identity unique while engaging with majority culture and would become the foundational principle of Reform Judaism. Here ends the quote. So it's instructive to note that although Hanukkah today is one of the most popular and recognizable of Jewish holidays, this is a relatively new and recent development, one rooted in American history and culture. For centuries, Hanukkah was considered a minor holiday, a festival with a distinct place in the Jewish calendar, but without the restrictions and the food and the special food and the activities that define other well-known holidays like Passover and Rosh Hashanah. For centuries, Hanukkah remained less religiously and culturally significant than almost any other Jewish holiday. But that all changed in the 20th century. Two major socio-political trends pushed Hanukkah to the forefront. First, of course, was the increase in commercialization of Christmas. In response to the seductiveness of Christmas, Jewish religious leaders and activists worked to shore up the celebration of Hanukkah. They did so in part by framing it as a meaningful alternative, complete with dramatic stories and family settings, and of course, gift-giving. In Europe, on the other hand, it was the Zionist movement that promoted Hanukkah as a holiday and celebrated a new Jewish ideal that was more politically and culturally assertive. At the time leading up to the founding of the modern Jewish state in Israel, the image of Judah Maccabee, the victorious Jewish warrior, had real appeal. So Hanukkah, in its current incarnation, is a relatively new tradition, based loosely on historical events, taken in some ways out of context. It was engineered, if you will, so to speak, as a way to preserve the Jewish identity at a time when assimilation into the dominant Western culture was a very real threat. I titled this sermon, Hanukkah, A Lesson for Us All, before I really knew where that material was going to take me. I was thinking of the parallels between attempted assimilation by the Jews into a Hellenistic culture in the 2nd and 1st centuries BCE with the assimilation of indigenous people of Turtle Island that's over the last two centuries and going on today. The takeaway here is that the Jewish culture has survived in large part because of the stories that it tells and the rituals that it has preserved. As Hanukkah shows us, these stories and rituals can be adapted to suit the times. None of this diminishes, of course, the importance of the thousands of years of recorded history, most notable in the Hebrew Bible and the associated Midrash, the Jewish sacred texts. But I see parallels in the emergence of indigenous literature and indigenous stories among us today. Most notably for me is the growing body of story and ritual around the relationship of the indigenous people to the land and the preservation of the ecosystems that support all life. Just as the Jewish people have taught Hebrew to their children over millennia, so too the indigenous peoples are now trying to recover their languages and pass them on to their children. Stories of the land, the preservation of language, the rituals, all provide a basis for identity and pride. So if Hanukkah is a lesson for us all, what's the lesson for Unitarian Universalists? If we're to preserve our faith traditions, we have to tell our stories. Stories of early Christian heretics, like Bishop Arius at the Council of Nicaea. Stories of the martyrs to the ideals of religious freedoms in the Middle Ages. Stories of our 20th century social justice work. In the words of Rabbi Feshbach, we must preserve what makes our faith tradition unique while engaging with the majority culture. We are unique as a faith tradition. Without creed or dogma, we welcome people of goodwill from all faith traditions or none. We seek to help each person on their own spiritual journey. Why, in the face of pressures to assimilate all cultures into one great melting pot, do we struggle to preserve our unique heritage? In the words of Neil, because we choose to. We choose to believe that our faith is a tradition worth fighting for. May it be so. Amen. You can play an interlude.